catered sandwiches and telling our favorite Elizabeth Wharton stories. The funeral home people will take care of the cremation. I'll decide what to do with the ashes after the three of them leave on Thursday. They'll never even have to look at the urn. That's a good idea. Thanks. But I dread the luncheon. Not Mrs. Green and the rest of Mom's few old friends, but them. If Aunt Charlotte freaks, Holly's apt to have a meltdown. You'll come to lunch too, won't you?
If you let me reach inside that shirt you're wearing, I'll do anything you want.
In that case, let me help you with the buttons.
4. Not many miles from where Kermit William Hodges and Janelle Patterson are lying together in the house on Harper Road, Brady Hartsfield is sitting in his control room. Tonight, he's at his work table instead of his bank of computers, and doing nothing. Nearby, lying amid the litter of small tools, bits of wire, and computer components, is the Monday paper, still rolled up inside its thin plastic condom. He brought it in when he got back from Discount Electronics, but only from force of habit. He has no interest in the news. He has other things to think about. How he's going to get the cop. How he's going to get into the Round Here concert at the Mac wearing his carefully constructed suicide vest. If he really intends to do it, that is. Right now it all seems like an awful lot of work. A long row to hoe. A high mountain to climb. But he can't think of any other similes. Or are those metaphors? Maybe, he thinks drearily, I just ought to kill myself now and be done with it. Get rid of these awful thoughts. These snapshots from hell. Snapshots like the one of his mother, for instance, convulsing on the sofa after eating the poisoned meat meant for the Robinson's family dog. Mom with her eyes bugging out and her pajama shirt covered with puke. How would that picture look in the old family album? He needs to think, but there's a hurricane going on in his head, a big bad Category 5 Katrina, and everything is flying. His old Boy Scout sleeping bag is spread out on the basement floor on top of an air mattress he scrounged from the garage. The air mattress has a slow leak. Brady supposes he ought to replace it if he means to continue sleeping down here for whatever short stretch of life remains to him. And where else can he sleep? He can't bring himself to use his bed on the second floor, not with his mother lying dead in her own bed just down the hall, maybe already rotting her way into the sheets. He's turned on her air conditioner and cranked it up to high cool, but he's under no illusions about how well that will work. Or for how long. Nor is sleeping on the living room couch an option. He cleaned it as well as he could and turned the cushions, but it still smells of her vomit. No. It has to be down here in his special place, his control room. Of course, the basement has its own unpleasant history. It's where his little brother died. Only, died is a bit of a euphemism, and it's a bit late for those. Brady thinks about how he used Frankie's name when he posted to Olivia Trelawney under Debbie's blue umbrella. It was as if Frankie was alive again for a little while. Only when the Trelawney bitch died, Frankie died with her. Died again.
I never liked you anyway,
he says, looking toward the foot of the stairs. It is a strangely childish voice, high and treble, but Brady doesn't notice.
Then I had to,
he pauses.
We had to.
He thinks of his mother and how beautiful she was in those days. Those old days.
5.
Deborah Ann Hartsfield was one of those rare ex-cheerleaders who, even after bearing children, managed to hang on to the body that had danced and pranced its way along the sidelines under the Friday night lights. Tall, full-figured, honey-haired. During the early years of her marriage, she took no more than a glass of wine with dinner. Why drink to excess when life was good sober? She had her husband. She had her house on the north side of the city, not exactly a palace, but what starter home was, and she had her two boys. At the time his mother became a widow, Brady was 8 and Frankie was 3. Frankie was a plain child and a bit on the slow side. Brady, on the other hand, had good looks and quick wits. Also, what a charmer. She doted on him, and Brady felt the same about her. They spent long Saturday afternoons cuddled together on the couch under a blanket, watching old movies and drinking hot chocolate, while Norm puttered in the garage and Frankie crawled around on the carpet, playing with blocks or a little fire truck that he liked so well he had given it a name, Sammy. Norm Hartsfield was a lineman for Central States Power. He made a good salary pole climbing, but had his sights trained on bigger things. Perhaps it was those things he was eyeing instead of watching what he was doing that day beside Route 51, or maybe he just lost his balance a little and reached the wrong way in an effort to steady himself. No matter what the reason, the result was lethal. His partner was just reporting that they'd found the outage and repair was almost complete when he heard a crackling sound. That was 20,000 volts of coal-fired CSP electricity pouring into Norm Hartsfield's body. The partner looked up just in time to see Norm tumble out of the cherry picker basket and plunge 40 feet to the ground with his left hand melted in the sleeve of his uniform shirt on fire. Addicted to credit cards, like most middle Americans as the end of the century approached, the Hartsfields had savings of less than $2,000. That was pretty thin, but there was a good insurance policy, and CSP kicked in an additional $70,000, trading it for Deborah Ann's signature on a paper absolving the company of all blame in the matter of Norman Hartsfield's death. To Deborah Ann, that seemed like a huge bucket full of cash. She paid off the mortgage on the house and bought a new car. Never did it occur to her that some buckets fill but once. She had been working as a hairdresser when she met Norm and went back to that trade after his death. 6 months or so into her widowhood, she began seeing a man she had met one day at the bank. Only a junior executive, she told Brady, but he had what she called prospects. She brought him home. He ruffled Brady's hair and called him Champ. He ruffled Frankie's hair and called him Little Champ. Brady didn't like him. He had big teeth, like a vampire in a scary movie. But he didn't show his dislike. He had already learned to wear a happy face and keep his feelings to himself. One night before taking Deborah Ann out to dinner, the boyfriend told Brady, "Your mother's a charmer, and so are you." Brady smiled and said thank you and hoped the boyfriend would get in a car accident and die. As long as his mother wasn't with him, that was. The boyfriend with the scary teeth had no right to take his father's place. That was Brady's job. Frankie choked on the apple during The Blues Brothers. It was supposed to be a funny movie. Brady didn't see what was so funny about it, but his mother and Frankie laughed fit to split. His mother was happy and all dressed up because she was going out with her boyfriend. In a little while, the sitter would come in. The sitter was a stupid, greedy guts who always looked in the refrigerator to see what was good to eat as soon as Deborah Ann left, bending over so her fat ass stuck out. There were 2 snack bowls on the coffee table. One contained popcorn, the other apple slices, dusted with cinnamon. In one part of the movie, people sang in church, and one of the Blues Brothers did flips all the way up the center aisle. Frankie was sitting on the floor and laughed hard when the fat Blues Brother did his flips. When he drew in breath to laugh some more, he sucked a piece of cinnamon-dusted apple slice down his throat. That made him stop laughing. He began to jerk around and claw at his neck instead. Brady's mother screamed and grabbed him in her arms. She squeezed him, trying to make the piece of apple come out. It didn't. Frankie's face went red. She reached into his mouth and down his throat, trying to get at the piece of apple. She couldn't. Frankie started to lose the red color. "Oh, my dear Jesus," Deborah Ann cried and ran for the phone. As she picked it up, she shouted at Brady, "Don't just sit there like an asshole. Pound him on the back." Brady didn't like to be shouted at, and his mother had never called him an asshole before, but he pounded Frankie on the back. He pounded hard. The piece of apple slice did not come out. Now Frankie's face was turning blue. Brady had an idea. He picked Frankie up by his ankles so Frankie's head hung down and his hair brushed the rug. The apple slice did not come out.
"Stop being a brat, Frankie," Brady said.
Frankie continued to breathe. Sort of. He was making little breezy whistling noises anyway. Almost until the ambulance got there. Then he stopped. The ambulance men came in. They were wearing black clothes with yellow patches on the jackets. They made Brady go into the kitchen so Brady didn't see what they did, but his mother screamed, and later he saw drops of blood on the carpet. No apple slice, though. Then everyone except Brady went away in the ambulance. He sat on the couch and ate popcorn and watched TV. Not the Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers was stupid. Just a bunch of singing and running around. He found a movie about a crazy guy who kidnapped a bunch of kids who were on their school bus. That was pretty exciting. When the fat sitter showed up, Brady said, Frankie choked on an apple slice. There's ice cream in the refrigerator. Vanilla crunch. Have as much as you want. Maybe, he thought, if she ate enough ice cream, she'd have a heart attack and he could call 911. Or just let the stupid bitch lay there. That would probably be better. He could watch her. Deborah Ann finally came home at 11 o'clock. The fat sitter had made Brady go to bed, but he wasn't asleep, and when he came downstairs in his PJs, his mother hugged him to her. The fat babysitter asked how Frankie was. The fat babysitter was full of fake concern. The reason Brady knew it was fake was because he wasn't concerned, so why would the fat babysitter care? He's going to be fine, Deborah Ann said with a big smile. Then, when the fat babysitter was gone, she started crying like crazy. She got her wine out of the refrigerator, but instead of pouring it into a glass, she drank straight from the neck of the bottle. He might not be, she told Brady, wiping wine from her chin. He's in a coma. Do you know what that is?
Sure, like in a doctor show.
That's right. She got down on one knee so they were face to face. Having her so close, smelling the perfume she'd put on for the date that never happened, gave him a feeling in his stomach. It was funny, but good. He kept looking at the blue stuff on her eyelids. It was weird, but good. He stopped breathing for a long time before the EMTs could make some room for the air to go down. The doctor at the hospital said that even if he comes out of his coma, there might be brain damage. Brady thought Frankie was already brain damaged. He was awful stupid carrying around that fire truck all the time, but said nothing. His mother was wearing a blouse that showed the tops of her titties. That gave him a funny feeling in his stomach, too.
If I tell you something, do you promise never to tell anyone? Not another living soul?
Brady promised. He was good at keeping secrets.
It might be better if he does die, because if he wakes up and he's brain damaged, I don't know what we'll do.
Then she clasped him to her, and her hair tickled the side of his face, and the smell of her perfume was very strong. She said,
Thank God it wasn't you, honey boy. Thank God for that.
Brady hugged her back, pressing his chest against her titties. He had a boner. Frankie did wake up, and sure enough, he was brain damaged. He had never been smart. Takes after his father, Deborah Ann said once. But compared to the way he was now, he had been a genius in those pre-apple slice days. He had toilet trained late, not until he was almost 3 1/2, and now he was back in diapers. His vocabulary had been reduced to no more than a dozen words. Instead of walking, he made his way around the house in a limping shuffle. Sometimes he fell abruptly and profoundly asleep, but that was only in the daytime. At night he had a tendency to wander, and before he started out on these nocturnal safaris, he usually stripped off his pampers. Sometimes he got into bed with his mother. More often he got in with Brady, who would awake to find the bed soaked and Frankie staring at him with goofy, creepy love. Frankie had to keep going to the doctor. His breathing was never right. At its best, it was a wet wheeze. At its worst, when he had one of his frequent colds, a rattling bark. He could no longer eat solid food. His meals had to be pureed in the blender, and he ate them in a high chair. Drinking from a glass was out of the question, so it was back to sippy cups. The boyfriend from the bank was long gone, and the fat babysitter didn't last either. She said she was sorry, but she just couldn't cope with Frankie the way he was now. For a while, Deborah Ann got a full-time home care lady to come in, but the home care lady ended up getting more money than Deborah Ann made at the beauty shop, so she let the home care lady go and quit her job. Now they were living off savings. She began to drink more, switching from wine to vodka, which she called a more efficient delivery system. Brady would sit with her on the couch drinking Pepsi. They would watch Frankie crawl around on the carpet with his fire truck in one hand and his blue sippy cup, also filled with Pepsi, in the other. "It's shrinking like the ice caps," Deborah Ann would say, and Brady no longer had to ask her what it was. "And when it's gone, we'll be out on the street." She went to see a lawyer in the same strip mall where Brady would years later flick an annoying goofy boy in the throat, and paid $100 for a consultation. She took Brady with her. The lawyer's name was Greensmith. He wore a cheap suit and kept sneaking glances at Deborah Ann's titties.
"I can tell you what happened," he said. "Seen it before. That piece of apple left just enough space around his windpipe to let him keep breathing. It's too bad you reached down his throat, that's all."
"I was trying to get it out," Deborah Ann said indignantly.
"I know, any good mother would do the same. But you pushed it deeper instead and blocked his windpipe entirely. If one of the EMTs had done that, you'd have a case, worth a few hundred thousand at least. Maybe 1.5 million. Seen it before. But it was you. And you told them what you did, didn't you?"
Deborah Ann admitted she had.
"Did they intubate him?"
Deborah Ann said they did.
"Okay, that's your case. They got an airway into him, but in doing so, they pushed that bad apple in even deeper." He sat back, spread his fingers on his slightly yellowed white shirt, and peeped at Deborah Ann's titties again, maybe just to make sure they hadn't slipped out of her bra and run away. "Hence, brain damage."
"So you'll take the case?"
"Happy to, if you can pay for the 5 years it'll drag through the courts, because the hospital and their insurance providers will fight you every step of the way, seen it before."
"How much?" Greensmith named a figure, and Deborah Ann left the office holding Brady's hand. They sat in her Honda, then new, and she cried. When that part was over, she told him to play the radio while she ran another errand. Brady knew what the other errand entailed, a bottle of efficient delivery system. She relived her meeting with Greensmith many times over the years, always ending with the same bitter pronouncement. "I paid $100 I couldn't afford to a lawyer in a suit from Men's Warehouse, and all I found out was I couldn't afford to fight the big insurance companies and get what was coming to me." The year that followed was 5 years long. There was a life-sucking monster in the house, and the monster's name was Frankie. Sometimes, when he knocked something over or woke Deborah Ann up from a nap, she spanked him. Once, she lost it completely and punched him in the side of the head, sending him to the floor in a twitching, eye-rolling daze. She picked him up and hugged him and cried and said she was sorry, but there was only so much a woman could take. She went into Hair Today as a sub whenever she could. On these occasions, she called Brady in sick at school so he could babysit his little brother. Sometimes Brady would catch Frankie reaching for stuff he wasn't supposed to have, or stuff that belonged to Brady, like his Atari arcade handheld, and then he would slap Frankie's hands until Frankie cried. When the wail started, Brady would remind himself that it wasn't Frankie's fault. He had brain damage from that that fucking apple slice, and he would be overcome by a mixture of guilt, rage, and sorrow. He would take Frankie on his lap and rock him and tell him he was sorry, but there was only so much a man could take. And he was a man, Mom said so, the man of the house. He got good at changing Frankie's diapers, but when there was poo, no, it was shit, not poo, but shit. He would sometimes pinch Frankie's legs and shout at him to lay still, damn you, lay still. Even if Frankie was laying still. laying there with Sammy the fire truck clutched to his chest and looking up at the ceiling with his big, stupid, brain-damaged eyes. That year was full of sometimes. Sometimes he loved Frankie up and kissed him. Sometimes he'd shake him and say, "This is your fault. We're going to have to live in the street, and it's your fault." Sometimes putting Frankie to bed after a day at the beauty parlor, Deborah Ann would see bruises on the boy's arms and legs. Once on his throat, which was scarred from the tracheotomy the EMTs had performed. She never commented on these. Sometimes Brady loved Frankie. Sometimes he hated him. Usually he felt both things at the same time, and it gave him headaches. Sometimes, mostly when she was drunk, Deborah Ann would rail at the train wreck of her life. "I can't get assistance from the city, the state, or the goddamn federal government, and why? Because we still have too much from the insurance and the settlement, that's why. Does anyone care that everything's going out and nothing's coming in? No. When the money's gone and we're living in a homeless shelter on Lowbriar Avenue, then I'll be eligible for assistance. It isn't that just ducky." Sometimes Brady would look at Frankie and think, "You're in the way. You're in the way, Frankie. You're in the fucking goddamn shit-ass way." Sometimes, often, Brady hated the whole fucking goddamn shit-ass world. If there was a God like the Sunday guys said on TV, wouldn't he take Frankie up to heaven so his mother could go back to work full-time and they wouldn't have to be out on the street? Or living on Lowbriar Avenue, where his mother said there was nothing but nigger drug addicts with guns? If there was a God, why had he let Frankie choke on that fucking apple slice in the first place? And then letting him wake up brain damaged afterward? That was going from bad to fucking goddamn shit-ass worse. There was no God. You only had to watch Frankie crawling around the floor with goddamn Sammy in one hand, then getting up and limping for a while before giving that up and crawling again, to know that the idea of God was fucking ridiculous. Finally, Frankie died. It happened fast. In a way, it was like running down those people at City Center. There was no forethought, only the looming reality that something had to be done. You could almost call it an accident. Or fate. Brady didn't believe in God, but he did believe in fate. And sometimes the man of the house had to be fate's right hand. His mother was making pancakes for supper. Frankie was playing with Sammy. The basement door was standing open because Deborah Ann had bought 2 cartons of cheap off-brand toilet paper at Chapter 11 and they kept it down there. The bathrooms needed restocking, so she sent Brady down to get some. His hands had been full when he came back up, so he left the basement door open. He thought Mom would shut it, but when he came down from putting the toilet paper in the 2 upstairs bathrooms, it was still open. Frankie was on the floor pushing Sammy across the linoleum and making sounds. He was wearing red pants that bulged with his triple-thick diapers. He was working ever closer to the open door and the steep stairs beyond, but Deborah Ann still made no move to close the door. Nor did she ask Brady, now setting the table, to do it. Said Frankie. He pushed the fire truck. Sammy rolled to the edge of the basement doorway, bumped against the jamb, and there he stopped. Deborah Ann left the stove. She walked over to the basement door. Brady thought she would bend down and hand Frankie's fire truck back to him, but she didn't. She kicked it instead. There was a small clacking sound as it tumbled down the steps all the way to the bottom. "Oops," she said. "Sammy faw down go boom." Her voice was very flat. Brady walked over. This was interesting. "Why'd you do that, Mom?" Deborah Ann put her hands on her hips, the spatula jutting from one of them. She said, "Because I'm just so sick of listening to him make that sound." Frankie opened his mouth and began to blat. "Quit it, Frankie," Brady said. But Frankie didn't. What Frankie did was crawl onto the top step and peer down into the darkness. In that same flat voice, Deborah Ann said, "Turn on the light, Brady, so he can see Sammy." Brady turned on the light and peered over his blatting brother.
Yep, he said. There he is, right down at the bottom. See him, Frankie?
Frankie crawled a little farther, still blatting. He looked down. Brady looked at his mother. Debran Hartsfield gave the smallest, most imperceptible nod. Brady didn't think. He simply kicked Frankie's triple-diapered butt, and down Frankie went, in a series of clumsy somersaults that made Brady think of the fat Blues Brother flipping his way along the church aisle. On the first somersault, Frankie kept on blatting, but the second time around, his head connected with one of the stair risers, and the blatting stopped all at once, as if Frankie were a radio and someone had turned him off. That was horrible, but had its funny side. He went over again, legs flying out limply to either side in a Y shape. Then he slammed head first into the basement floor.
Oh my God, Frankie fell!
Deborah Ann cried. She dropped the spatula and ran down the stairs. Brady followed her. Frankie's neck was broken. Even Brady could tell that, because it was all croggled in the back. But he was still alive. He was breathing in little snorts. Blood was coming out of his nose. More was coming from the side of his head. His eyes moved back and forth, but nothing else did. Poor Frankie. Brady started to cry. His mother was crying, too.
What should we do? Brady asked. What should we do, Mom?
Go upstairs and get me a pillow off the sofa.
He did as she said. When he came back down, Sammy the fire truck was lying on Frankie's chest.
I tried to get him to hold it, but he can't,
Deborah Ann said. Yeah, Brady said. He's probably paralyzed.
Poor Frankie.
Frankie looked up, first at his mother, and then his brother.
Brady,
he said. It'll be okay, Frankie, Brady said, and held out the pillow. Deborah Ann took it and put it over Frankie's face. It didn't take long. Then she sent Brady upstairs again to put the sofa pillow back and get a wet washcloth.
Turn off the stove while you're up there, she said. The pancakes are burning. I can smell them.
She washed Frankie's face to get rid of the blood. Brady thought that was very sweet and motherly. Years later, he realized she'd also been making sure there would be no threads or fibers from the pillow on Frankie's face. When Frankie was clean, although there was still blood in his hair, Brady and his mother sat on the basement steps looking at him. Deborah Ann had her arm around Brady's shoulders.
I better call 911, she said.
Okay.
He pushed Sammy too hard, and Sammy fell downstairs. Then he tried to go after him and lost his balance.
I was making the pancakes, and you were putting toilet paper in the bathrooms upstairs.
You didn't see anything.
When you got down to the basement, he was already dead.
Okay. Say it back to me.
Brady did. He was an A student in school and good at remembering things.
No matter what anybody asks you, never say more than that. Don't add anything and don't change anything.
Okay. But can I say you were crying? She smiled. She kissed his forehead and cheek. Then she kissed him full on the lips.
Yes, honey boy, you can say that.
Will we be all right now?
Yes. There was no doubt in her voice. We'll be fine.
She was right. There were only a few questions about the accident and no hard ones. They had a funeral. It was pretty nice. Frankie was in a Frankie-sized coffin wearing a suit. He didn't look brain damaged, just fast asleep. Before they closed the coffin, Brady kissed his brother's cheek and tucked Sammy the fire truck in beside him. There was just enough room. That night, Brady had the first of his really bad headaches. He started thinking Frankie was under his bed, and that made the headache worse. He went down to his mom's room and got in with her. He didn't tell her he was scared of Frankie being under his bed, just that his head ached so bad he thought it was going to explode. She hugged him and kissed him, and he wriggled against her tight, tight, tight. It felt good to wriggle. It made the headache less. They fell asleep together,
and the next day, it was just the two of them, and life was better.
Debra Ann got her old job back, but there were no more boyfriends. She said Brady was the only boyfriend she wanted now. They never talked about Frankie's accident, but sometimes Brady dreamed about it. He didn't know if his mother did or not, but she drank plenty of vodka, so much she eventually lost her job again. That was all right, though, because by then he was old enough to go to work. He didn't miss going to college, either. College was for people who didn't know they were smart.
6. Brady comes out of these memories, a reverie so deep it's like hypnosis, to discover he's got a lap full of shredded plastic. At first he doesn't know where it came from. Then he looks at the newspaper lying on his work table and understands he tore apart the bag it was in with his fingernails while he was thinking about Frankie. He deposits the shreds in the waste basket, then picks up the paper and stares vacantly at the headlines. Oil is still gushing into the Gulf of Mexico, and British Petroleum executives are squalling that they're doing the best they can and people are being mean to them. Nadal Hassan, the asshole shrink who shot up the Fort Hood Army base in Texas, is going to be arraigned in the next day or two. You should have had a Mercedes, Nadal, baby, Brady thinks. Paul McCartney, the ex-Beatle Brady's mom used to call Old Spaniel Eyes, is getting a medal at the White House. Why is it, Brady sometimes wonders, that people with only a little talent get so much of everything? It's just another proof that the world is crazy. Brady decides to take the paper up to the kitchen and read the political columns. Those in a melatonin capsule might be enough to send him off to sleep. Halfway up the stairs, he turns the paper over to see what's below the fold and freezes. There are photos of two women side by side. One is Olivia Trelawney. The other one is much older, but the resemblance is unmistakable, especially those thin bitch lips. Mother of Olivia Trelawney dies, the headline reads. Below it, protested daughter's unfair treatment. Claimed press coverage destroyed her life. What follows is a two-paragraph squib, really just an excuse to get last year's tragedy, if you want to use that word, Brady thinks rather snidely, back on the front page of a newspaper that's slowly being strangled to death by the internet. Readers are referred to the obituary on page 26, and Brady, now sitting at the kitchen table, turns there double-quick. The cloud of dazed gloom that has surrounded him ever since his mother's death has been swept away in an instant. His mind is ticking over rapidly, ideas coming together, flying apart, then coming together again like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. He's familiar with this process and knows it will continue until they connect with a click of finality and a clear picture appears. Elizabeth Seroy Warden, 87, passed away peacefully on May 29, 2010 at Warsaw County Memorial Hospital. She was born on January 19, 1923, the son of Marcel and Catherine Seroy. She is survived by her brother, Henry Seroy, her sister, Charlotte Gibney, her niece, Holly Gibney, and her daughter, Janelle Patterson. Elizabeth was predeceased by her husband, Alvin Warden, and her beloved daughter, Olivia. Private visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Soames Funeral Home on Tuesday, June 1, followed by a 10 a.m. memorial service at Soames Funeral Home on Wednesday, June 2. After the service, a reception for close friends and family members will take place at 729 Lilac Drive in Sugar Heights. The family requests no flowers, but suggests contributions to either the American Red Cross or the Salvation Army, Mrs. Wharton's favorite charities. Brady reads all this carefully with several related questions in mind. Will the FedEx cop be at the visitation? At the Wednesday memorial service? At the reception? Brady's betting on all three. Looking for the perk. Looking for him. Because that's what cops do. He remembers the last message he sent to Hodges, the good old dead rat. Now he smiles and says it out loud. He won't see me coming. Make sure he doesn't, Debra Ann Hartsfield says. He knows she's not really there,
but he can almost see her sitting across the table from him, wearing a black pencil skirt, and the blue blouse he especially likes, the one that's so filmy you can see the ghost of her underwear through it.
Because he'll be looking for you.
I know, Brady says. Don't worry.
Of course I'll worry, she says. I have to. You're my honey boy.
He goes back downstairs and gets into his sleeping bag. The leaky air mattress wheezes. The last thing he does before killing the lights via voice command is to set his iPhone alarm for 6:30. Tomorrow is going to be a busy day. Except for the tiny red lights marking his sleeping computer equipment, the basement control room is completely dark. From beneath the stairs, his mother speaks.
I'm waiting for you, honey boy, but don't make me wait too long.
I'll be there soon, Mom. Smiling, Brady closes his eyes. 2 minutes later, he's snoring. 7. Janie doesn't come out of the bedroom until just after 8 the following morning. She's wearing her pantsuit from the night before. Hodges, still in his boxers, is on the phone. He waves one finger to her, a gesture that says both good morning and give me a minute. It's not a big deal, he's saying, just one of those things that nibble at you. If you could check, I'd really appreciate it. He listens. Nah, I don't want to bother Pete with it, and don't you either. He's got all he can handle with the Donald Davis case. He listens some more. Janie perches on the arm of the sofa, points at her watch, and mouths,
The viewing.
Hodges nods. That's right, he says into the phone. Let's say between the summer of 2007 and the spring of 2009. In the Lake Avenue area downtown where all those new ritzy condos are. He winks at Janie. Thanks, Marlo, you're a doll. And I promise I'm not going to turn into an uncle, okay? Listens, nodding. Okay. Yeah, I have to run, but give my best to Phil and the kids. We'll get together soon. Lunch. Of course on me. Right. Bye. He hangs up.
You need to get dressed in a hurry, she says. Then take me back to the apartment so I can put on my damn makeup before we go over to the funeral home. It might also be fun to change my underwear. How fast can you hop into your suit?
Fast, and you don't really need the makeup.
She rolls her eyes. Tell that to Aunt Charlotte. She's totally on crow's feet patrol. Now get going and bring a razor. You can shave at my place.
She rechecks her watch.
I haven't slept this late in 5 years.
He heads for the bedroom to get dressed. She catches him at the door, turns him toward her, puts her palms on his cheeks, and kisses his mouth.
Good sex is the best sleeping pill. I guess I forgot that.
He lifts her high off her feet in a hug. He doesn't know how long this will last, but while it does, he means to ride it like a pony.
And wear your hat, she says, looking down into his face and smiling. I did right when I bought it. That hat is you.
8. They're too happy with each other and too intent on getting to the funeral parlor ahead of the relatives from hell to Bolo, but even on red alert they almost certainly wouldn't have seen anything that rang warning bells. There are already more than 2 dozen cars parked in the little strip mall at the intersection of Harper Road and Hanover Street, and Brady Hartsfield's mud-colored Subaru is the most unobtrusive of the lot. He has picked his spot carefully so that the FedEx cop street is squarely in the middle of his rear view. If Hodges is going to the old lady's viewing, he'll come down the hill and make a left on Hanover. And here he comes at just past 8:30, quite a bit earlier than Brady expected since the viewing's not until 10 and the funeral parlor's only 20 minutes or so away. As the car makes its left turn, Brady is further surprised to see the FedEx cop is not alone. His passenger is a woman, and although Brady only gets a quick glimpse, it's enough for him to ID Olivia Trelawney's sister. She's got the visor down so she can look into the mirror as she brushes her hair. The obvious deduction is that she spent the night in the FedEx cop's bachelor bungalow. Brady is thunderstruck. Why in God's name would she do that? Hodges is old, he's fat, he's ugly. She can't really be having sex with him, can she? The idea is beyond belief. Then he thinks of how his mother relieved his worst headaches and realizes, reluctantly, that when it comes to sex, no pairing is beyond belief. But the idea of Hodges doing it with Olivia Trelawney's sister is infuriating, not in the least because you could say it was Brady himself who brought them together. Hodges is supposed to be sitting in front of his television and contemplating suicide. He has no right to enjoy a jar of Vaseline in his own right hand, let alone a good-looking blonde. Brady thinks, she probably took to bed while he slept on the sofa. This idea at least approaches logic and makes him feel better. He supposes Hodges could have sex with a good-looking blonde if he really wanted to. But he'd have to pay for it. The whore would probably want a weight surcharge, too, he thinks, and laughs as he starts his car. Before pulling out, he opens the glove compartment, takes out Thing 2, and places it on the passenger seat. He hasn't used it since last year, but he's going to use it today. Probably not at the funeral parlor, though, because he doubts they will be going there right away. It's too early. Brady thinks they'll be stopping at the Lake Avenue condo first, and it's not necessary that he beat them there, only that he be there when they come back out. He knows just how he's going to do it. It will be like old times. At a stoplight downtown, he calls Tones Frobisher at Discount Electronics and tells him he won't be in today. Probably not all week. Pinching his nostrils shut with his knuckles to give his voice a nasal honk, he informs Tones that he has the flu. He thinks of the Round Here concert at the Mac on Thursday night in the suicide vest and imagines adding, "Next week I won't have the flu, I'll just be dead." He breaks the connection, drops his phone onto the seat next to Thing 2, and begins laughing. He sees a woman in the next lane, all gussied up for work, staring at him. Brady, now laughing so hard, tears are streaming down his cheeks and snot is running out of his nose, gives her the finger. 9. You were talking to your friend in the records department, Janie asks.
Marlowe Everett, yeah, she's always in early. Pete Huntley, my old partner, used to swear that was because she never left.
What fairy tale did you feed her, pray tell?
That some of my neighbors have mentioned a guy trying cars to see if they were unlocked. I said I seemed to recall a spate of car burglaries downtown a couple of years back, the doer never apprehended.
Uh-huh. And that thing you said about not turning into an uncle, what was that about?
Uncles are retired cops who can't let go of the job. They call in wanting Marlowe to run the plate numbers of cars that strike them as hinky for one reason or another. Or maybe they brace some guy who looks wrong, go all cop-faced on his ass, and ask for ID. Then they call in and have Marlowe run the name for wants and warrants.
Does she mind?
Oh, she bitches about it for form's sake, but I don't really think so. An old geezer named Kenny Shays called in a 6-5 a few years ago. That's suspicious behavior, a new code since 9/11. The guy he pegged wasn't a terrorist, just a fugitive who killed his whole family in Kansas back in 1987.
Wow. Did he get a medal?
Nothing but an attaboy, which was all he wanted. He died 6 months or so later. Ate his gun is what Kenny Shays did, pulling the trigger before the lung cancer could get traction. Hodges' cell phone rings. It's muffled, because he's once more left it in the glove compartment. Janie fishes it out and hands it over with a slightly ironic smile. Hey, Marlowe, that was quick. What did you find out? Anything?
He listens, nodding along with whatever he's hearing and saying, uh-huh, and never missing a beat in the heavy flow of morning traffic.
He thanks her and hangs up, but when he attempts to hand the Nokia back to Janie, she shakes her head.
Put it in your pocket. Someone else might call you. I know it's a strange concept, but try to get your head around it. What did you find out?
Starting in September of 2007, there were over a dozen car break-ins downtown. Marlowe says there could have been even more, because people who don't lose anything of value have a tendency not to report car burglaries. Some don't even realize it happened. The last report was logged in March of 2009, less than 3 weeks before the city center massacre. It was our guy, Janie. I'm sure of it. We're crossing his back trail now, and that means we're getting closer.
Good.
I think we're going to find him. If we do, your lawyer, Sean, goes downtown to fill in Pete Huntley. He does the rest. We still see eye to eye on that, don't we?
Yes, but until then, he's ours. We still see eye to eye on that, right?
Absolutely. He's cruising down Lake Avenue now, and there's a spot right in front of the late Mrs. Wharton's building. When your luck is running, it's running. Hodges backs in, wondering how many times Olivia Trelawney used this same spot. Janie looks anxiously at her watch as Hodges feeds the meter. Relax, he says. We've got plenty of time. As she heads for the door, Hodges pushes the lock button on his key fob. He doesn't think about it. Mr. Mercedes is what he's thinking about, but habit is habit. He pockets his keys and hurries to catch up with Janie so he can hold the door for her. He thinks, I'm turning into a sap. Then he thinks, so what?
10. 5 minutes later, a mud-colored Subaru cruises down Lake Avenue. It slows almost to a stop when it comes abreast of Hodges' Toyota. Then Brady puts on his left turn blinker and pulls into the parking garage across the street. There are plenty of vacant spots on the first and second levels, but they're all on the inside and no use to him. He finds what he wants on the nearly deserted third level, a spot on the east side of the garage, directly overlooking Lake Avenue. He parks, walks to the concrete bumper, and peers across the street and down at Hodges' Toyota. He puts the distance at about 60 yards. With nothing in the way to block the signal, that's a piece of cake for Thing 2. With time to kill, Brady gets back into his car, fires up his iPad, and investigates the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex website. Mingo Auditorium is the biggest part of the facility. That figures, Brady thinks, because it's probably the only part of the MAC that makes money. The city symphony orchestra plays there in the winter, plus there are ballets and lectures and arty-farty shit like that. But from June to August, the Mingo is almost exclusively dedicated to pop music. According to the website, Round Here will be followed by an all-star summer cavalcade of song, including the Eagles, Sting, John Mellencamp, Alan Jackson, Paul Simon, and Bruce Springsteen. Sounds good, but Brady thinks the people who bought all concert passes are going to be disappointed. There's only going to be one show in the Mingo this summer, a short one ending with a punk ditty called Die, You Useless Motherfuckers. The website says the auditorium's capacity is 4,500. It also says that the Round Here concert is sold out. Brady calls Shirley Orton at the ice cream factory. Once more pinching his nose shut, he tells her she better put Rudy Stanhope on alert for later in the week. He says he'll try to get in Thursday or Friday, but she better not count on it. He has the flu. As he expected, the F-word alarms Shirley. Don't you come near this place until you can show me a note from your doctor saying you're not contagious. You can't be selling ice cream to kids if you've got the flu.
I'd know, Brady says through his pinched nostrils. I'd be sorry, Shirley. I think I got it from my mother. I had to put her to bed.
That hits his funny bone and his lips begin to twitch.
Well, you take care of yours.
I have to go, he says, and breaks the connection just before another gust of hysterical laughter sweeps through him.
Yes, he had to put his mother to bed. And yes, it was the flu. Not the swine flu or the bird flu, but a new strain called gopher flu. Brady howls and pounds the dashboard of his Subaru. He pounds so hard he hurts his hand, and that makes him laugh harder still. This fit goes on until his stomach aches and he feels a little like puking. It has just begun to ease off when he sees the lobby door of the condo across the street open. Brady snatches up Thing 2 and slides the on switch. The ready lamp glows yellow. He raises the short stub of the antenna. He gets out of his car, not laughing now, and creeps to the concrete bumper again, being careful to stay in the shadow of the nearest support pillar. He puts his thumb on the toggle switch and angles Thing 2 down, but not at the Toyota. He's aiming at Hodges, who is rummaging in his pants pocket. The blonde is next to him, wearing the same pantsuit she had on earlier, but with different shoes and purse. Hodges brings out his keys. Brady pushes Thing 2's toggle switch, and the yellow ready lamp turns operational green. The lights of Hodges' car flash. At the same instant, the green light on Thing 2 gives a single quick blink. It has caught the Toyota's PKE code and stored it, just as it caught the code of Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes.
Brady used Thing 2 for almost 2 years, stealing PKEs and unlocking cars so he could toss them for valuables and cash. The income from these ventures was uneven, but the thrill never faded. His first thought on finding the spare key in the glove compartment of Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes, it was in a plastic bag along with her owner's manual and registration, was to steal the car and joyride it all the way across the city. Bang it up a little just for the hell of it. Maybe slice the upholstery. But some instinct had told him to leave everything just as it was, that the Mercedes might have a larger role to play. And so it had proved. Brady hops into his car and puts Thing 2 back in his own glove compartment. He's very satisfied with his morning's work, but the morning isn't over. Hodges and Olivia's sister will be going to a visitation. Brady has his own visitation to make. The Mac will be open by now, and he wants a look around. See what they have for security. Check out where the cameras are mounted. Brady thinks, I'll find a way in. I'm on a roll. Also, he'll need to go online and score a ticket to the concert Thursday night. Busy, busy, busy. He begins to whistle. 11. Hodges and Janie Patterson step into the eternal rest parlor of the Soames funeral home at 9:45, and thanks to her insistence on hurrying, they're the first arrivals. The top half of the coffin is open. The bottom half is swaddled in a blue silk swag. Elizabeth Wharton is wearing a white dress sprigged with blue florets that match the swag. Her eyes are closed, her cheeks are rosy. Janie hurries down an aisle between two ranks of folding chairs, looks briefly at her mother, then hurries back. Her lips are trembling. Uncle Henry can call cremation pagan if he wants to, but this open coffin shit is the real pagan rite. She doesn't look like my mother. She looks like a stuffed exhibit. Then why? It was the trade-off I made to shut Uncle Henry up about the cremation. God help us if he looks under the swag and sees the coffin's pressed cardboard painted gray to look like metal. So it'll... You know. I know, Hodges says, and gives her a one-armed hug. The deceased women's friends trickle in, led by Althea Green, Wharton's nurse, and Mrs. Harris, who was her housekeeper. At 10:20 or so, fashionably late, Hodges thinks, Aunt Charlotte arrives on her brother's arm. Uncle Henry leads her down the aisle, looks briefly at the corpse, then stands back. Aunt Charlotte stares fixedly into the upturned face, then bends and kisses the dead lips. In a barely audible voice, she says, Oh, sis. Oh, sis. For the first time since he met her, Hodges feels something for her other than irritation. There is some milling, some quiet talk, a few low outbursts of laughter. Janie makes the rounds, speaking to everyone. There aren't more than a dozen, all of the sort Hodges' daughter calls Goldie Oldies, doing her due diligence. Uncle Henry joins her, and on the one occasion when Janie falters, she's trying to comfort Mrs. Green, he puts an arm around her shoulders. Hodges is glad to see it. Blood tells, he thinks. At times like this, it almost always does. He's the odd man out here, so he decides to get some air. He stands on the front step for a few moments, scanning the cars parked across the street, looking for a man sitting by himself in one of them. He sees no one, and realizes he hasn't seen Holly, the mumbler, either. He ambles around to the visitor's parking lot, and there she is, perched on the back step. She's dressed in a singularly unbecoming shin-length brown dress. Her hair is put up in unbecoming clumps at the sides of her head. To Hodges, she looks like Princess Leia after a year on the Karen Carpenter diet. She sees his shadow on the pavement, gives a jerk, and hides something behind her hand. He comes closer, and the hidden object turns out to be a half-smoked cigarette. She gives him a narrow, worried look. Hodges thinks it's the look of a dog that's been beaten too many times with a newspaper for piddling under the kitchen table.
Don't tell my mother. She thinks I quit.
Your secret's safe with me, Hodges says, thinking that Holly is surely too old to worry about Mommy's disapproval of what is probably her only bad habit. Can I share your step?
Shouldn't you be inside with Janie?
But she moves over to make room. Just taking a breather. With the exception of Janie herself, I don't know any of those people.
She looks him over with the bald curiosity of a child.
Are you and my cousin lovers?
He's embarrassed, not by the question, but by the perverse fact that it makes him feel like laughing. He sort of wishes he'd just left her to smoke her illicit cigarette. Well, he says, we're good friends. Maybe we should leave it at that. She shrugs and shoots smoke from her nostrils.
It's all right with me. I think a woman should have lovers if she wants them. I don't myself. Men don't interest me. Not that I'm a lesbian. Don't get that idea. I write poetry.
Yeah, do you?
Yes.
And with no pause, as if it's all the same thing.
My mother doesn't like Janie.
Really?
She doesn't think Janie should have gotten all that money from Olivia. She says it isn't fair. It probably isn't, but I don't care myself.
She's biting her lips in a way that gives Hodges an unsettling sense of déjà vu, and it takes only a second to realize why. Olivia Trelawney did the same thing during her police interviews. Blood tells. It almost always does. You haven't been inside, he says.
No, and I'm not going. And she can't make me. I've never seen a dead person, and I'm not going to start now. It would give me nightmares.
She kills her cigarette on the side of the step, not rubbing it, but plunging it out, stabbing it until the sparks fly and the filter splits. Her face is as pale as milk glass. She started to quiver. Her knees are almost literally knocking. And if she doesn't stop chewing her lower lip, it's going to split open.
This is the worst part,
she says, and she's not mumbling now. In fact, if her voice doesn't stop rising, it will soon be a scream.
This is the worst part. This is the worst part. This is the worst part.
He puts an arm around her vibrating shoulders. For a moment, the vibration grows to a whole body shake. He fully expects her to flee, perhaps lingering just long enough to call him a masher and slap his face. Then the shaking subsides, and she actually puts her head on his shoulder. She's breathing rapidly. You're right, he says. This is the worst part. Tomorrow will be better.
Will the coffin be closed?
Yeah. He'll tell Janie it will have to be unless she wants her cuz sitting out here with the hearses again. Holly looks at him out of her naked face. She doesn't have a damn thing going for her, Hodges thinks. Not a single scrap of wit, not a single wile. He will come to regret this misperception. But for now, he finds himself once more musing on Olivia Trelawney, how the press treated her, and how the cops treated her, including him.
Do you promise it'll be closed?
Yes.
Double promise?
Pinky swear if you want. Then, still thinking of Olivia and the computer poison Mr. Mercedes fed her, are you taking your medication, Holly? Her eyes widen.
How do you know I take Lexapro? Did she tell you?
Nobody told me. Nobody had to. I used to be a detective. He tightens the arm around her shoulders a little and gives her a small friendly shake. Now answer my question.
It's in my purse. I haven't taken it today because, she gives a small shrill giggle, because it makes me have to pee.
If I get a glass of water, will you take it now?
Yes, for you.
Again, that naked stare, the look of a small child sizing up an adult.
I like you. You're a good guy. Janie's lucky. I've never been lucky in my life. I've never even had a boyfriend.
I'll get you some water, Hodges says, and stands up. At the corner of the building, he looks back. She's trying to light another cigarette. But it's hard going because the shakes are back. She's holding her disposable Bic in both hands like a shooter on the police gun range. Inside, Janie asks where he's been. He tells her and asks if the coffin can be closed at the memorial service the following day. I think it's the only way you'll get her inside, he says. Janie looks at her aunt, now at the center of a group of elderly women, all of them talking animatedly. That bitch hasn't even noticed Holly's not in here, she says. You know what? I just decided the coffin's not even going to be here tomorrow. I'll have the funeral director stash it in the back, and if Auntie C doesn't like it, she can go spit. Tell Holly that, okay? The discreetly hovering funeral director shows Hodges into the next room where drinks and snacks have been arranged. He gets a bottle of Dasani water and takes it out to the parking lot. He passes on Janie's message and sits with Holly until she takes one of her little white happy caps. When it's down, she smiles at him.
I really do like you.
And using that splendid, police-trained capacity for telling the convincing lie, Hodges replies warmly, "I like you too, Holly." 12. The Midwest Culture and Arts Complex, a.k.a. the MAC, is called the Louvre of the Midwest by the newspaper and the local Chamber of Commerce. The residents of this Midwestern city call it the Louvre,